Babe Ruth hit 714 home runs in his major league career. This you might already know. But as a professional baseball player in general, Ruth hit 715 home runs. One home run. He hit one home run in the minors. Ruth was so good as a pitcher, mind you, that it wasn't long before he was in the bigs to stay. But where did he hit that minor league home run? It wasn't in New York, or near Boston, or even in his hometown of Baltimore. So where? Well, would you believe? That's right. Babe Ruth hit his first professional home run in Canada. He was a member of the Providence Grays then, and his team was playing another minor league club, the, get this, Toronto Maple Leafs. It was on September 5th, 1914, and there is still a plaque commemorating it where the right field bleachers of Hanlon's Point used to be. As it happens, baseball has a long history in our neighbor to the north, dating back to the mid-1800s. There was even a variant of the game in Ontario called the Canadian game, which included five bases, cricket bats, and 11 players per team. Fergie Jenkins is the only Hall of Famer to hail from the Great White North, but a few past stars like Larry Walker and Eric Gagne are Canadian, as are current stars Joey Votto, Justin Morneau, and John Axford. Canada at one point had 24 minor league teams, and one of those teams, the Montreal Royals, was the home in 1946 for a new signing by the Brooklyn Dodgers, Jackie Robinson. Canada had two major league teams at one point, but only the Toronto Blue Jays remain. We'll talk about that other team a little later. But beyond MLB, the game still goes on in Canada, as it does in many other countries around the world. It may be America's pastime, but it has grown to be an international game. Miguel Cabrera, Albert Pujols, Shinsu Chu, Aroldis Chapman, Ichiro Suzuki, the influence of international-born players has never been greater. One of the old adages about baseball is that it can be played anywhere, a field, a street, a backyard, a sandlot. But it's becoming clear that now anywhere means literally anywhere, from the most impoverished nations to the wealthiest. There are leagues in Asia, South America, Africa, and Australia. But beyond big-name players that hail from there, how much do we know about baseball in other countries? Has the transition of America's pastime to other countries been lost in translation? From the Earl Weaver Memorial Studios in Minneapolis, Minnesota, this is Stealing Home. I'm your host, David Temple. Rejoice, everyone. Baseball is upon us once again. Since the first real competition we'll see this year will be in the form of the World Baseball Classic, we're going to look at international baseball. Jonah Carey will join us to talk more about baseball in Canada, specifically the French-speaking area. Then we'll talk to Tom Fee, a young upstart in the Australian Baseball League, though not as a player. And filmmaker John Fitzgerald will join us and talk about his work to help build a very special facility in Europe. All that, plus a non-traditional version of the MVP of my heart, it's all coming up on Stealing Home. Let's play ball. We start every episode with a little bit of news as we check in on the goings-on in baseball. Today, we're talking to Aaron Gleeman, writer for NBC Sports and AaronGleeman.com. Aaron, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Signings are still occurring as we approach spring training, but the biggest contract didn't go to a free agent. Instead, it was a monster contract extension landed by Seattle Mariners pitcher Felix Hernandez to the tune of 7 years and $175 million. If you're going to invest that kind of time and money into a pitcher, Hernandez at least seems like one of the safer bets. Aaron, does this signify that perhaps the Mariners are ramping up to make a postseason push sometime in the near future?
You would hope so. I mean, they're sort of in a spot where they seem to have been kind of perpetually rebuilding since they made that run kind of post A-Rod a while back. And, you know, like you said, if you're going to invest that much, he's the type of guy you do it. He's still young. I think he's only going to be 33 maybe when that contract is over. But, yeah, they're certainly not a contender for this year. But they do have a bunch of prospects that they've stockpiled, you know, for years of being bad. You would say, and, you know, he seems to like Seattle. It seems to be a good fit that way. But, yeah, it's interesting because they could be, I mean, we've seen that a few times. I know I've seen that locally with the Twins and Joe Mauer, where now the Twins are spending an incredible amount of money on one player, and the rest of the team is pretty weak. And for the short term, at least, it looks like the Mariners are going to be in that same boat for a while.
Do you think this has something to do with the Mariners don't want to find themselves in contention the same year that maybe Hernandez is up for a contract or, you know, is up for free agency or something like that? They don't want to get caught, you know, with the short end of the stick once they become a good team?
It could be. I mean, it's also, there's, you know, I'm generally kind of conservative when it comes to, let's say, the $100 million plus contracts, just because the rate of those working out over the years, I mean, there have been a lot that have been not bad for the team, but the number that have been truly good for the team at the end of the contract is so limited that I'm sort of conservative that way. But I think we just can't even predict what it's going to be in terms of revenue. I mean, I think starting next year, every team's getting $25 million from the national TV deal in addition to what they have now. So that basically pays for Hernandez every year, just that bump from the national deal. Then you have the local contracts that are getting renegotiate all the time. Then you have the MLBAM sort of internet money. So I think it's a situation where no matter if they think they're going to be good in 2014 or 2015 or whatever, he's young enough that you can make the long-term commitment to him. And the money, it's a lot. Like you said, it's the biggest deal ever for a pitcher. But, you know, who's to say in 5 years when they're in the middle of that deal, will $25 million a year for a stud pitcher even be, you know, such a huge investment?
Well, that brings me to my next point. This big payday doesn't just affect Hernandez and the Mariners. Two other big-name pitchers are candidates for contract extensions soon, the Tigers' Justin Verlander and the Dodgers' Clayton Kershaw. Both these teams have flashed their considerably deep pockets in the past. Can we expect Hernandez's record deal to be broken soon?
I think it will be. I mean, that's just how it goes. But I think Kershaw, the more interesting thing to me is who's going to get to $200 million first, because I think we're within the next year or certainly 18 months or so, we're going to see that. And I think Kershaw is similar to Hernandez in that he's extremely young and extremely, you know, productive for a player nearing free agency. I mean, he came up very early with the Dodgers, was basically an elite pitcher almost right away, got the Cy Young, and then he finishes runner-up for the Cy Young, and I think he's still only 25. So I really think if someone's going to get a 7 or 8 year commitment, it's going to be him, whereas Verlander, I think, is 29 or 30, so he's 4 or 5 years older. And then the other thing is, like you said, both those teams are throwing around money, but the Dodgers are throwing around money like I think nobody in baseball history. So you add that to Kershaw's age, how elite he's been, I really think you got to come to him with an extension. You have to start at 7 or 8 years, and if you use Felix Hernandez's deal as the baseline, you're getting awfully close to $200 million there.
The other big news, besides pitchers and catchers reporting, I suppose, is the Indians signing Michael Bourne, ending what I'm sure wasn't a very pleasant offseason for him. Bourne was one of the bigger free agents this offseason, but it seemed that teams in need of a center fielder weren't interested in foregoing the draft pick in order to sign him. The Indians, having a protected pick, took the chance and signed Bourne to a 4-year deal. Aaron, the Indians already have a full outfield with Nick Swisher, Drew Stubbs, and Michael Brantley. Are we expecting a trade here, or is Cleveland going to try and figure out this situation on the fly?
I wouldn't be shocked if they traded somebody, but it sounds like their initial plan is to basically go with three center fielders in the outfield, move Swisher to first base, and then put Mark Reynolds at DH. It's interesting because they're definitely one of the more sabermetric slanted teams, and they've, you know, invested a ton of time and resources into kind of their own defensive metrics and stuff like that. So it seems like they didn't love any of the options at the DH spot. They didn't think there'd be, let's say, a 25-run above average hitter they could plug in there. So they just said, well, why not get a average-ish hitter in Bourne, which he is, I think, if you include the base running, and then kind of slide everyone down the defensive spectrum which is obviously going to help the pitching staff a ton. But if they can pick up, you know, 3 runs here, 5 runs there by having, you know, center fielders in corner spots, you pick up a little bit more by not having Reynolds on the field anywhere. It might not add up to 25 runs, but it could add up to, you know, 15, 20 runs. It's certainly an interesting approach, and it's, I think it'll be an interesting test case to look at their pitching stats because, you know, they certainly haven't had great pitching for the last few years. But if you trot out 3 center fielders and a decent shortstop and a decent second baseman, you're going to have some really good numbers with balls in play. And I think, you know, we're going to approach like midseason and people are going to be maybe shocked, or at least people in the mainstream, the casual fans, might be shocked by what the numbers from some of the Cleveland pitchers, and it's going to be because of the defense.
You and your partners at Hardball Talk have a running joke going on. Hardball Talk is the baseball branch of NBC Sports. You have a running joke going on about the constant slew of reports coming in that a player is in the best shape of his life. As someone who ostensibly reads baseball stories for a living, like you do, and then writes about them, are there any other trends that you notice this time of year?
Well, there's a few. I mean, first of all, everyone who's coming back from Tommy John surgery is way ahead of schedule. There's nobody who's really behind schedule. And then everyone who had a great year last year is, of course, doing work to, you know, maintain that. And everyone who had a terrible year has, of course, changed some, you know, approach at the plate or added a new pitch to, you know, get back on track. It's amazing how, and I guess that's just natural. I mean, you can't really write an article if you're a guy at a newspaper or MLB.com and say, so-and-so kind of showed up 5 pounds overweight. I bet he's going to stink this year. It's so much easier just to assume everyone did the right thing during the offseason and everyone is on the right page in terms of having, you know, a peak year in 2013. But it is funny how quickly, because, I mean, in 2 weeks from right now, there's going to be 5 injured guys on each team, and all those kind of showed up in great shape, got their eyes on the prize stories are going to be completely forgotten.
And as baseball fans, you know, after a long offseason, offseason seems to get longer every year now. It's always, you need something to read, and if it's a dozen reports about a pitcher adding a cutter, it always seems to be a cutter that a pitcher seems to pitch, they seem to learn, and hitters adding leg kicks or getting rid of leg kicks. That's always the other one.
You're right about the leg kicks. I saw, like, I forget the players now, like 2 or 3 of those in the last maybe like 48 hours, how the guy had a bad year and someone else on the team turned things around with a leg kick and they're adding, if only it was that easy, if only like you could move your finger 1 inch on the pitch and add a cutter and just kind of, you know, change your leg kick at the plate and boost your average by 50 points. It's a hard thing to do, but somebody really should devote a website to just sort of tracking these preseason optimism and just how do they do? Is there any correlation between the guys who lost weight, added leg kicks, added a cutter, like you said, and is there at all any correlation to how well they perform? I bet maybe a tiny bit, but not much.
Well, any aspiring writers out there can take a free tip from longstanding baseball blogger Aaron Gleeman. Aaron Gleeman is a writer for NBC Sports as well as a podcaster and champion drinker, if I do say so myself. You can find out all about him at aarongleeman.com. Aaron, thanks for joining us.
Yep, anytime.
If you like the show, don't forget to give us a positive review on iTunes. Positive ratings and reviews help us get more exposure, which helps us get more listeners. If you have already, thank you very much, but if you haven't, go on over to iTunes, take 20 seconds, and rate and review the show. It'll be a big help. Thanks. We touched a little on Canadian baseball at the top of the show, but I wanted to look more into the recent history, so I reached out to possibly the most famous Canadian baseball fan, at least as far as baseball writers go. Jonah Carey is a writer for Grantland and the author of the New York Times bestseller The Extra 2%, How Wall Street Strategies Took a Major League Baseball Team From Worst to First, which chronicles the rise of the Tampa Bay Rays in 2008. He now lives in Colorado, but spent much of his youth growing up in Montreal and cheering for the now-defunct Expos. In fact, he's writing a new book about the Expos. Having never been to Montreal, I wanted to know more about what baseball meant to that city, so I spoke with Jonah to get the inside scoop. Jonah Carey, thank you so much for joining us on Stealing Home.
Thanks for having me, David.
I think there's a sort of unfair stereotype about Canadians that they're just a nicer version of Americans. And regardless to the extent that that's true, I think people from Quebec, French Canadians, seem like a totally different breed, if you will. Leaving baseball out for a second, can you explain the biggest discrepancies between Canadians and French Canadians?
Yeah, I mean, it's tricky. I am from Quebec, but English is still my first language. I do speak French, but I don't know if I would qualify as a French Canadian per se, but obviously grew up around French Canadians. Yeah, Quebec is a distinct culture. I just think that there are different things going on. And Montreal in particular probably skews a little bit closer toward a European type of lifestyle than maybe, I don't know, Winnipeg or Regina or Moose Jaw might. So it's a little different in that respect. And I think it's just, it is very distinct in the way that, you know, you're dealing with multiple cultures at once. You can walk down the street in Montreal and you walk from one street to the other, and everybody's going to speak some variant of both languages, but you will get majority one versus majority other, depending on what block you're on to some degree. So I think that's fascinating and a wonderful thing to be able to experience that growing up.
You've written extensively about your childhood growing up as an Expos fan, and you wrote a particularly touching farewell letter to them for Baseball Prospectus. You make mention of Olympic Stadium, the Big O, quite a bit, and how you spent a great deal of your time growing up watching games there. You've been to many baseball parks in your day, I'm sure. What about the Big O made it so special?
I think it's just where you know, your formative years are spent. You know, I've talked to Mets fans who went to Shea Stadium and Astros fans at the Astrodome and Mariners fans at the Kingdome. These are cruddy stadiums by any objective measure. Not necessarily a wonderful place to watch a game. I wrote a book about the Tampa Bay Rays. Tropicana Field, I think, falls under that same category too. But, you know, it's where your favorites are. It's where you are as a kid. It's where you go with your dad or your grandfather or your mom or whoever, and you enjoy it. And as you get older, you know, that sentimentality sticks with you a little bit. So, you know, there were things that were endemic to the Big O, aside from the sentiment. It was very, very loud. Even if there weren't that many people there, the noise you could generate, if you had a crowd of even 20,000 and they were jazzed up about something, that's like 60,000 in Yankee Stadium. And it was just an incredible thing. Just the acoustics of the place, the way that you could bang these plastic chairs and create this kind of echoing sound, it was a pretty crazy thing. And it just had this general party atmosphere. And again, you didn't need a full house to get that. It was just one of those things where the people that went, they were really invested in the game. You know, baseball fans, certainly real baseball fans, but also people that just knew how to have a good time. And I always appreciated that. You know, if we were going to go on a Friday night or whatever, it was part of a whole fun evening. The idea was we'd go to the Big O and we'd watch the game for 2.5 hours and we'd go to the bars, and it was a whole, you know, you go to the bars when you're young in Quebec. So, you know, 17, 18 years old, you're already doing that. And it was just a whole experience. We really, really got to enjoy. And even when I was younger than that, even when I was a little kid, I just remember just always having a good time and always felt like a big party at the stadium.
I want to talk to you a little bit more about the noise. I've done most of my baseball watching in the Metrodome, the former home of the Twins. I remember I took my dad to a Brewers Twins game, and he had never been to the Metrodome before. And it's Brewers Twins games are always fairly rowdy, and they, you know, tend to get loud. And he was amazed just how loud that place could get. I remember October 2009, game 163 versus the Tigers, as possibly the loudest experience of my life. And I'm not being hyperbolic. I'm actually being quite literal.
Sure.
I felt vibrations in my body for hours after we left. For the uninitiated, I was hoping you could explain just a little bit more about just the noise and the sound level that you can get in a place like Olympic Stadium.
Yeah, well, I mean, the dome, anytime you have something like a dome, it's going to have that because, you know, the air isn't, the sound isn't escaping through the air. It's not an open-air stadium, so that lends to it to some extent. But the Big O is just, it was a funny place. You know, it was built for the Olympics in 1976, and at first it did have an open roof, and they tried to build a retractable roof. Retractable roof didn't work, so they ended up just keeping the roof on. And it was never a baseball facility. It was this big, just cavernous place. It was just, it's immense. I mean, if you look at it, if you're driving in Montreal, or you go there for the first time, and it looks like a spaceship landed in the middle of the east end of Montreal. It's a very strange thing. And, you know, for whatever reason, the architecture and the acoustics and all that, it just sort of all came together to create that feel. And then, you know, I talked about the plastic seats and all that. They're also, I mean, if you've ever watched a soccer match in another country, they have these horns. They call them vuvuzelas. I think they really took off in the last World Cup. I guess it was in South Africa where we really saw a lot of that. You know, you heard a lot of that. Well, in Montreal, they have similar things. They have these big, giant plastic horns. And you would hear, not many, you know, maybe a few dozen people would have them, but that thing echoed all over the place. And if you had people cheering and screaming and banging the seats and blowing the horns, it was just, it was weird. I mean, it's like Mardi Gras or Carnival or maybe a Twins game in 2009.
Beyond the stadium itself, what do you remember most about Montreal fans as a culture? I imagine that, just like anything else, they take baseball a little differently than Americans or you know, other Canadians from different parts of the country.
Well, and I'm writing this book about the Montreal Expos, and, you know, I've interviewed a lot of people going back all the way. I mean, this is a book about 1969 to 2004, and I wasn't alive for the entire duration. And, you know, what you found was the most popular period was when they were winning the most, which makes the most sense, I guess, was roughly 79 to 82 or so. And at that point, what you found was, it was an interesting time as far as what the fans were like. I can remember going to hockey games when I was a little kid. We were very fortunate. I didn't have many hookups as a kid, but one of them that we had was we were friends with one of the members of the Molson family. The Molson family is in the beer, as in the owners of the Montreal Canadiens. So whenever I went to a game when I was, you know, literally 13 or 14 years old, I sat first row behind the net, which is unbelievable. Me and an idiot buddy were 14 years old. Yeah, so it was great. And those people were fancy people. They wore fur coats and full suits and, you know, this is the 80s. We're not talking about the 30s here. This is not that long ago, and people were just really dressed in the nines, and it was a big to-do. That's what Expos games were like in the early 80s. When the team was really good, and actually the Canadians were kind of not as good as they had been, the Expos arguably surpassed the Canadians, surpassed hockey in terms of popularity at that point in the franchise's history. It was just such a to-do. And, you know, there's different kinds of to-dos. At that point, that was maybe the beautiful people that did it. But later on, when you get to the 90s and the team starts to become good again, I don't know if the fur coat crowd came back necessarily, but definitely you had a younger group of fans, you know, teenagers, kids, 20s, 30s, whatever, and they were into it as well, and then that became the thing to do. And then everybody would show up to the ballpark in that way as well, and again, it would be part of their Friday night or part of their Saturday night or even part of their Wednesday night. It was a big event, and it was always a big walk-up crowd. You know, you didn't have, after the 80s, you didn't have that big season ticket base. People would just get off work. They'd either, you know, take the subway straight in or whatever. Or if you were in school, you said, okay, what do you want to do tonight? Or we're going to the Expos game. And you just walk up and you'd stand in this huge line and you'd buy tickets. And it was a cool setup. The metro station, the subway station, was actually connected to the stadium. So literally, if you worked downtown, you could get out of your office building. Often you would never have to go into the fresh air. You would just go straight down into the tunnels, get on the subway, get off the subway, go into through the tunnels into the stadium and into your seat. You would never see daylight. It would just be going from one end to the other. It was a very, very unique experience. That stadium, where it was, the types of people that went there, and what you got out of it. There really isn't any other ballpark that I can think of, and I've been to almost all of them, that really compares in quite that way.
The move of the Expos has had at least a little silver lining for you. As you mentioned, you now get to chronicle the history of the team that you love. How has it been, without getting, you know, too specific about the book, obviously, just how has it been interviewing players and coaches that you grew up idolizing?
Oh, it's the best. It's the best thing I've ever had to do professionally. It's fantastic. I mean, writing is, you know, it's always going to be a challenge, no matter how good a writer you are. And I don't profess to be any genius writer, but, you know, it's a challenge to write 100,000 words or whatever it is you're going to do. But the interviewing, man, you know, the only thing I have to watch out for is not pulling the old Chris Farley show and saying, hey, remember that time in 1985? That was awesome. You know, I have to be careful not to do that. But I've been a journalist long enough that even though I'm talking to Timmy Raines and Larry Walker and some of my favorite players of all time, I still pretty much keep it in check, and I'm able to ask intelligent questions. And, you know, it's really cool in some ways. I think any retired player is going to have, you know, the gift of perspective, and we'll be able to look back and be wistful and nostalgic and so forth. But when it's a team that's defunct, I feel like you almost get the higher level that people really reach down deep, you know? And maybe my questions are helping too. I don't want to say that's impossible that I'm not asking good questions, but there's just, I'm able to draw some stuff out of them that maybe they wouldn't think about in their day-to-day life. And it's really interesting to hear their perspectives, you know, certainly about the games and the records and whatever, but also just about, you know, I asked them, where did you live in the city? What did you do? What was your daily routine? Where did you go out to eat? You know, who'd you hang out with? And the book is going to, you know, it's a baseball book, but I think it's a little bit of a love letter to Montreal, too. I think it's just sort of, maybe not on purpose, but it sort of ended up that way because people, universally, all these players, all these coaches, they just loved being there. You know, they come from Florida or California or Alabama or Minnesota or whatever, and they show up, and the players are 22 years old. Most of them lived in the same building, by the way. It was like this big Melrose Place building where all the players went and hooked up and went out at night, and it was all downtown. And I mean, if you were a single guy and you're making some money and you're in your early 20s, you got to go to Montreal with the women there and the nightlife and whatever. It's just, it's out of control how much fun they had. You know, these stories I'm hearing from other players from other teams too, they would talk about Whitey Herzog, famously the manager of the Cardinals. He wouldn't fly his team into Montreal until the day of the game. In other words, let's say they had a day off on a Monday and they were playing Tuesday night. He'd wait until Tuesday or 1 o'clock in the afternoon to arrive in town because he knew that if he left them in town for an extra night, oh, that's it. They'd be finished. They'd go out drinking. They would, you know, gallivanting and what have you the night before, and they'd be done. And the Expos home record in their peak years, it's beyond just a statistical, you know, a typical statistical trend where, okay, home teams play better. There was just a marked difference in their home record compared to other teams. I'm going to use some statistical analysis in this book when it's appropriate. I think that's a good one. It was just a really amazing time that the players really got behind and loved. So I think that, you know, for people who maybe know something about the Expos and about baseball, but maybe not necessarily about that city, it'll be a little bit of an eye-opener too. I hope that I'm not pouring it on too thick because it's still a baseball book ultimately, but I feel like some context is necessary to really describe that place and time and what the players got out of being in that city as opposed to taking nothing away from these places but Cleveland or Milwaukee or Kansas City.
Or Minneapolis-St. Paul.
Or Minneapolis, sure.
Jonah Carey, I wish you great success with your book and certainly look forward to reading it. Thank you so much for joining us on Stealing Home.
Thanks for having me.
Jonah Carey is a writer for Grantland and a New York Times bestselling author. His new book about the Montreal Expos is due out next year. You can follow him on Twitter at JonahKerei. Imagine a Friday morning, waking up and getting out of bed. You maybe take a shower or brew some coffee, but whatever your routine is, imagine it being interrupted 10 minutes into it by some random guy from another country wanting to talk about baseball. That random guy is me, and that interrupted morning belongs to Tom Fee, an Australian baseball fan. In fairness, he did know I was calling. Anyway, hello. Thanks for doing this, by the way. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's fine. I listen to
festival. Tom plays organ and writes for the Perth Heat, one of the teams involved in the Australian Baseball League, which is a summer league of sorts. Tom was nice enough to chat with me, and since he lives on the other side of the world, we spoke via Skype. You may notice some quality issues here and there, but I suspect that has to do with the internet in Australia spinning counterclockwise or something. Can you tell me a little bit about Tom came to the game late, at least later than most American children. He was turned to the sport by a song and a Wikipedia binge. I'll let him explain.
My mom's from Minnesota, and she was a baseball fan, but she never really talked to me about it or mentioned it. I guess she distanced herself from America once she left. But once I started getting to music when I was in my teens and I really got in this band, Belle and Sebastian, there was a song called Piazza New York Catcher. And And when he sung lyrics like the catcher hits for 318, I was a bit confused. What's that about? So I went on Wikipedia and I looked up what an average was, and from there, you know, when you go on Wikipedia and you click on one thing then the next, and it just, you know, it leads to a 3-hour session, and then by the end of that, I think I bought a MLB TV subscription, and I guess the rest is history.
Holy moly! So you went you went from a Wikipedia hole to at least that's what I call it, Wikipedia hole to a MLB subscription. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. It may not have been that quick. I think I made the decision to do it, but because I was a student, I may not have pulled the plug right there. But I was definitely saying yes, that I was definitely going to try and follow baseball from then on.
A lot of things about baseball were endearing to Tom at first, but it was the sheer volume of games that really sealed the deal for him.
The first thing, it was a bit of a wow moment because I just love sport. I'd watch lawn bowls when I was a kid, you know. If it was on TV, I'd watch it. So Test cricket was great because it'll be a 5-day event. And I'd be like, wow, I can watch cricket for 5 straight days. And then I read about the Twins having a horrible season. And it was something about how they only won 70 games. And I thought, 70 games, that's amazing. No one wins 70 games in a season and has a bad year. And then I realized that they play 162 games in a year, and that was just amazing. I just thought, baseball every day. And then it kind of clicked how it's a part of the American psyche, because it's just a backdrop to your summer. Like every day you can turn on the TV and there's baseball, and I can kind of see how it's connected so much with American people from there.
So Tom was hooked, but he didn't stop there. He did something that many baseball fans dream of and actually got a job working for the team. What happened in the middle? How did that turn about?
Well, there's this kind of attitude in Australia, which we're fighting at the moment, and it's that the MLB is the best and the Australian baseball is not as good. So a lot of people didn't pay attention to that. And I was in that middle ground. But I started going to the games when the MLB... I really started going to the games as soon as Major League Baseball put an investment in Australian baseball as a winter league. And everything changed. The atmosphere was different. You could tell that they were really trying to promote it. And I guess I got caught up in that. And so I guess it was something in the seventh inning, I just talked to my friends and I got them to talk me into trying to play organ for them. So it was probably about a 20-minute conversation going, should I, shouldn't I? And eventually I just ran and talked to their general manager, who you could tell because he was out there with the fans and he's talking with everyone, promoting everything. And he was really excited from the start. He said, that's a great idea. Let's do it. Next series, bring your organ in. And yeah, it just went from there.
Did you know the kind of tunes, the usual tunes that go on at a ballpark? Did you have to sit at home and learn those before you showed up?
My knowledge was pretty much what everyone else's knowledge in Australia is, which is a da-na-na-na-na, which is what everyone does when you explain to them what a baseball organist is. They recognize the charge theme, but nothing else. So, because I'd been to 2 Major League Baseball games in my life up to then. So I knew a few things, like from the Twins, I knew what Sue Nelson would play because I'd watched so many of their games. So what I did, I contacted her somehow through the Musicians Union in Minnesota, and she really wanted to talk to me. So we slowed up a Skype chat like this, but well, she didn't have Skype, so I had to use a payphone. And because she's a bit older, I had to call her at her time, which turned out to be 1 a.m. our time, which happened to be when I was in the city watching Australia in the World Cup or something like that in soccer. And so there's a giant... just everyone's partying around me and having a good time on the streets. And I'm there talking to Sue Nelson on the phone, taking notes and listening to her sing to me while she sounded exactly like my grandma as well, which was really weird with a Minnesota accent.
So you learned how to play baseball tunes on the organ via an international payphone call at 1 in the morning while all your friends were watching soccer or football or whatever you call it over there.
Yeah, plus I suddenly started listening or following other teams that had organists. So instead of just watching random games, I choose home games of teams who have a decent organist and take notes whenever I heard something.
That is dedication. Now, was this a volunteer position, or did they slip you a few bucks every now and then?
A few bucks would be the most accurate thing. It's definitely for love. everyone works down here for love except the people who are right at the top. It's mostly American interns who can, they can get the MLB on their resume and they can get a trip to Australia, and that's enough for probably anyone who's into baseball to come over, you know, have a semi-expenses paid trip to Australia, and you get the experience with MLB in the process. So it's hard to negotiate money when there's a lot of free help.
Yeah, I can imagine. I have like a house and a, you know, family now, but I can imagine even 5 years ago, if I had had I known about it, you know, jumping at the opportunity. That sounds really cool. Now, how did you transfer from organist to writer for the Perth Heat? Because you write, I'm looking at their website here, and your name is on most of these articles on their website.
Yeah, I started writing anonymously for another website, which was a very humor-based, just take the mickey, just write about all the funny things. And I wrote anonymously because I didn't want other people to know it was me, and I didn't want other people to not tell me stuff because I'd be worried I wrote about it. And but eventually everyone figured that out by the end of the first season, and they really liked it. And eventually all the Americans go back to America, so we have a skeleton crew, which is kind of what's happened now. Everyone's headed home, and there's 2 Australians and 2 Americans left in our office. So I got to write about the Heat in the off season, which is mainly writing about Hughes and Hendricks and how they were going over in America. And then as soon as the season started, I told them I wanted to keep doing it, and now I'm there, one of their main writers.
I'm looking at an article that you wrote. The title is "Cavalry Take Championship with Game 2 Win." I want to read you the first sentence. With a 7-6 victory over the Alcohol Think Again Perth Heat, the Canberra Cavalry secured their first Claxton Shield in a front of a sellout crowd at Narrabunda Ballpark. Hardly any of that makes sense. Could you explain some of this for me? What's the Claxton Shield first? Can we talk about that?
Yeah, that's the best thing in that sentence for me. It's a shield that's been running since... my history is catching up with me now. I'm not too sure, but I'd say since about the 30s. So it's quite big now. It started as a small wooden shield, and as the years go, it just grows out.
When you mean it grows bigger, do people keep adding parts to the?
Yeah, because there's only enough space to put team names on, and since I suppose there's about 100 or. Yeah, probably about 100 little badges on there now of a state that's won. So it started off as a state competition in the 30s, and it's changed depending on how the league is, because we had probably a 10-team league in the 90s, so it stopped being the state title and just went to the best team. And now it is still kind of a state competition because there's only one team per state, but it's now the trophy for the Australian Baseball League as opposed to just being the national championships, which is slightly different because that was a state competition. Now it's whoever's in the league wins it.
It's at this point that our Skype connection goes bad. So I call him back and we start talking about the differences he notices between the ABL and the MLB.
It's obviously just a lot bigger in America. I'd love to compare what we do to a minor league game, but I've not been to an American minor league game, but, In America, it's the be all and end all. I've been to Fenway and I've been to Yankee Stadium and it's just a completely different thing. I would say there's a massive step up in quality, but from someone who probably doesn't know heaps about baseball, it's hard for me to tell the difference. But I do notice that there's a lot more errors in our league than you'd expect in the American League, but from a fan perspective, it would be the same difference between following a team in single A or double A and then going down to a major league ballpark.
We then lose our connection again, but make it work a few minutes later, and I ask Tom about the history of the Australian Baseball League.
It's hard for me to talk personally about the past because I only came around as soon as the ABL started off, but I think it's been a pretty solid just a state competition since the 30s. So there's always going to be some kind of baseball competition in Australia. So the Claxton Shields followed that around. It was massive in the 90s. American culture just became huge. in the 90s, and basketball was massive, and the Perth Heat was massive. So it took off really well for probably 4 or 5 years from what I'm hearing. But then I guess interest waned, and the league really outgrew itself and kind of collapsed because it just tried to go for too much. So since then, it really quietened down through the early 2000s, and the national tournament would be a round robin event that would be held over 1 or 2 weeks, that kind of thing. But I guess Major League Baseball really saw, with all the Australian talent and with the need to have some more winter leagues, the massive benefit of playing in Australia. And it's great because we can pick and choose from all the other leagues around Australia. We get guys from Korea and guys from Japan, like Daesung Koo is a regular for the Sydney Blue Sox, who might not be a household name in America, but I know personally that he's a god in Korea because we played in the Asia Series in Korea in November, and we signed Koo for a week as kind of a publicity stunt for when we went to Korea, and working with the team, it was one of my jobs to walk with Koo through the stadium, and that everyone's really respectful, but when they see Koo, they just change and they run up to him and grab his autograph, and it would take, you know, 10, 15 minutes for a 2-minute walk, and he was so great. He signed everyone's autograph, and he was really friendly, and yeah, it's amazing getting to see stuff like that in the Australian Baseball League. It's amazing where things can take you, I guess, when you just volunteer to play organ and suddenly two years later you're in Korea escorting one of the gods of Korean baseball around a ballpark.
If you had to, and I don't mean to put you on the spot, and I'm certainly not going to hold you to it, but if you had to pick somebody that you saw recently play in the Australian Baseball League, you know, tournament, who's somebody we don't know about that maybe, you know, might make a splash over here in MLB?
Make a splash would be a bit of a hard way to go, but I wouldn't be surprised to see probably maybe 5 or 6 of the guys I saw play this year get to the majors. I mean, there's guys who get to the majors like Liam Hendricks, but seeing it's hard to predict who's going to be big like Travis Blackley or Grant Balfour, who are really big to us, but maybe not big names in America either. But there's one guy who I'm really hoping makes it. He's a 16-year-old, Sam Kennelly. And if you follow minor league baseball, you'd know his brothers. Like there's Tim Kennelly, who plays for the Phillies in AA. His other brother, Matt Kennelly, plays in AA for the Braves. His third brother, Josh, plays rookie ball with the Reds. So he's the fourth person in the family to be signed. And the word going around is that he's the best out of the four, from what I'm hearing from the guys in Perth. So I'm sure that's a pretty rare thing, having four guys signed from one family to Major League Baseball. But we've got access to those guys in Perth. And I'm really hoping that Sam can get to the majors. And he's with the Pirates now. He signed with them probably for a fairly decent signing bonus when he was 16, probably 6 months ago. And I think he'd probably go about 20 games in with us, and didn't go great, but he's showed a lot of potential, and we're really rooting for him to get up there.
The day we talked, the news came out about Australian Grant Balfour needing knee surgery, which led us to talk about some Australians currently in the MLB, like another ace pitcher, Travis Blackley.
Yeah, it was great when just having two guys with the A's at the moment. And we had Luke Hughes. He signed with the A's for about a week, but was a disaster, I guess. But when he signed, my GM was trying to make me call Billy Bean. Like there's this little red book we've got, and it has a phone numbers for everyone in Major League Baseball, like every contact. And he said, there's Billy Bean's number, call him and get a quote. And I was like, I don't know, man, this is scary. There's no way I want to disturb him and make him annoyed that some Australian team called him about Luke Hughes. So he rang him, and I don't think Billy Bean was too happy about it, but he still gave us a quote for our story, which was great. And he really talked up the Australian guys in his team. Even though the Luke Hughes experiment didn't go well, I'm glad that Travis Blackley and Balfour's really pulled through for them.
And do you think the success of guys like Blackley and Balfour and Hendricks, do you think that'll help, you know, not just fans, but general managers of teams get exposure to Australian. Do you see more ABL guys coming over? Is that some, or not even ABL guys, but just Australian born players? Do you see more of them coming over in the next, you know, 10 years or so?
Yeah, there's, I think this year there was a story on the Team Australia website that this year's class, you'd call it, had the most signings since 2000 and, or maybe I think it was since 98 or something. So more Australians got signed this year to major league teams than ever before. And I think it works both ways. We had a guy, Virgil Vasquez, who you may not know, but he pitched a couple games in the majors. He got signed to the Twins, and you might see him in AAA or AA this year. And another guy who's probably going to be our MVP, Bishini, who was another American who came over. He got signed to the Padres from his work that he did over here. And that's really great seeing Americans come over and get signed, because I think that's one of the whole reasons behind the league. So it's good. We're seeing a lot of Australians get noticed and a few Americans come over too. And it's always the same teams. It's nearly always the Twins, because there's one twin scout in Australia who probably signs half of the Australian talent who goes through. But there's a few other guys. There's a Detroit guy, and most of our managers have links with major league teams as well, which is how Bishini went to the Padres.
So the ABLX kind of, it's like a two-way street. It's not only for Australian guys to get noticed, but also, you know, guys coming from the States or, you know, Asia or something like that, who maybe got passed over the first time, to come over and kind of make a name for themselves and try and get back on track, huh?
Yeah, well, both Bishini and Vasquez, the two guys who got signed, there was a similar story. They had great talent, and then they got injured. And they've used the Australian Baseball League as a way to come back. And it expands their horizons. Like, Vasquez got noticed by a twin scout who wouldn't have already noticed him if he was in Australia. And Bishini got noticed by his manager, who works for the Padres, or has worked for the Padres. And that's how he ended up getting signed with them. So if you stand out in our league, everyone's kind of talking about when is he going to get signed, when someone's going to pick him up.
We then lose our connection again, but Tom had to get going to work anyway. I, on the other hand, had to shovel snow before it got too dark, which illustrates just how different our lives are, but that they can be brought together by baseball and some partially functioning technology. Tom Fee is a writer and organist for the Perth Heat. A big thanks to him for taking his morning to talk. You can follow him on Twitter at THOMFEE. Don't forget that Stealing Home is on social media. Go to our Facebook site at facebook.com/stealinghomeradio, or check us out on Twitter at stealinghome.org, where you can get all the updates about the show. Thanks. Chances are you live, say, a 20-minute drive at most from some sort of baseball field, be it at a school or in a park or even a minor or major league stadium. That is, if you're an American listener. If you are listening from another country, and I know some of you are, your mileage may vary. But there's one country, a country you've all heard of, where they may have to drive a long way to get to a ballpark because the entire country only has one. And that one doesn't have any bleachers or an outfield wall. That country is Ireland. You probably didn't see that coming, but it's true, though they're looking to change that. There's a fundraising program going on at fieldodreams.com. That's fieldodreams.com. They're asking for donations in return for a copy of a documentary, The Emerald Diamond, which lays out the story of how professional baseball came to be in Ireland. It's a cool film, and you can check out a truncated version at their website. The filmmaker, John Fitzgerald, has started Baseball United Foundation, which is the group gathering funds to place a full baseball facility in Ashburn, Ireland. I wanted to know more about this project, so I called him at his home in New York. John, thank you so much for joining us on Stealing Home.
Thanks for having me on, David.
To start off, I was hoping you could talk about how you came across the subject of Irish baseball and what made you want to make a film about it.
Sure. Well, I guess it was back in 2004. I had recently stopped playing baseball. I played a little bit in college and I played in high school. And then I played in summer leagues for a few years after that. And I recently stopped. And I think I wrote an article in the newspaper about Greece's Olympic team, the Greek Olympic team, and how they had just put together a team from scratch for the Olympics. And it got me thinking. And I wondered if Ireland had a team. And being of Irish American heritage, I did some research. I found that they did have a team, and they had actually played competitively since 1996. And at the time, I wanted to play, and I figured, you know, I was only maybe a year or two out of playing myself, and I figured I could definitely get back into shape and play. And so I contacted them, and I started working out, and I was ready to go. And I found out during the course of that time that I was actually ineligible. You need a parent or a grandparent with Irish citizenship, and I missed by one generation. So at that point, I had heard a lot of stories. I had emailed back and forth with some of the players and coaches, and I talked to them on the phone, and it sounded like a great story. And I, at the time, was just getting started in the film business, and I decided to take a leap and see if I could make a documentary. It was the first documentary I ever made, and the first time I had ever directed a feature film. But it was, you know, it was about two things that I am really passionate about, and that's you know, my Irish American heritage and baseball. So it was a lot of fun to explore and figure out how to do this, you know, on the fly, because, you know, I was really interested in the topic. And that's how, it, you know, the whole documentary came to be.
Had you ever been to Ireland before?
No, I actually had not. So the first time I went over, I actually flew over with my good friend, Bill Winters, who's a world-renowned cinematographer, but we played Little League Baseball together, so he agreed to come out and just kind of help me out and just see if we had a story. And we flew out. So my first day in Ireland, we got off the plane and we were, you know, basically exhausted. And we did our first interview that day. And so my first day in Ireland, I spent at their only field in Ireland.
And the whole, well, after you were done with this, you decided to start a charitable foundation, the Baseball United Foundation. And the impetus of this group is to basically build a new baseball facility in Ireland. From what I understand, there's two already, one for adults sort of, and one for youth baseball. But this is more of a, I don't want to say complex, but it's more of an all-encompassing, you know, baseball facility. Is that right?
Right. Yeah. And they have, they've got two fields, a youth field and an adult field in Dublin. But they're beautiful fields. They're well-maintained, but it's in a public park. And that was really the only place they could get land at the time. This was in 1998. And, you know, baseball was really, it's a young sport in Ireland today, but back then it was just starting. So they basically were able to secure land in a park on the condition that they didn't build any permanent structures. So there's no bleachers, there are no bullpens, there's, you know, a fence for the backstop, which over there is a big deal, and they actually have bases. And that's the only place in Ireland that you're going to find that. So it's great, and it is beautiful. And, you know, I've actually played an exhibition game over there, and it's a lot of fun to play on, and it's a good field, but it's not a real, you know, ballpark type of field. I mean, there are Little League fields in America all over the place that are much better than what the Irish national team plays on. So this fundraiser, the Field of Dreams fundraiser, is actually focused on helping the Irish complete funding for a new field, which will be in Ashbourne, which is about 20 miles north of Dublin. So it'll be the first field in Ireland with bullpens, a real backstop, dugouts, you know, the whole thing, outfield fence. Their outfield fence on the field they currently have is just bushes. They're well maintained and it looks like an outfield fence, but it's basically, the agreement is that if baseball does not, you know, maintain popularity and people stop playing, they'll just basically bulldoze it and it'll be gone tomorrow. So they're trying to build something that's a little bit more permanent.
And I want to jump back to the Irish national team, the subject of your film. This is a group that started, I believe, right around 2000, thereabouts. Is that correct, or is it a little bit before?
No, they actually, their first international competition was 1996.
96, it goes, okay.
Yeah.
But this team basically started as kind of a softball collective and morphed itself into a baseball team that not very long after went, you know, to play some international competition and did better than they expected, it sounded like, from the interviews. What sense, I mean, you weren't there for the actual games at the get-go, but what kind of sense did you get from those players on what those first international competitions were like?
They were pretty bad early on. The whole transition from COVID softball to a men's only international baseball team, that took place in 1995, and the first competition was 1996. And basically, at the time, it was a bunch of guys that realized they were the only ones in the country that wanted to play baseball, and there really was nothing stopping them from becoming the first national baseball team of Ireland. So just by the fact that they would be willing to practice, put on uniforms, and show up, they could represent their country. And that was really, it meant a lot to them. And that's really the whole reason it got started. It wasn't, you know, an ego thing or whatever. They just realized we can do this for our country. And they did. But the only problem was at the time, they hadn't been playing very long, and some guys, you know, weren't too familiar with the rules. Other guys just, you know, didn't have the arm strength or the experience of hitting or catching or throwing. And some guys did, and you know, they were, you know, a little bit better off. But on the whole, the team ended up got pounded pretty bad in the first few games, and the first few years were rough, and it was a struggle because as they're losing these games, their pride and their ability to convince other people to play was being challenged. And that's really the central theme of the documentary, which, you know, really kind of focuses on what made these guys stick it out. You know, when you're getting beaten so badly, why do you keep doing it? And through perseverance, they were able to get better, and they were also able to recruit better Irish athletes and find some players from America that had Irish citizenship, that played college ball or high school ball. And slowly they got better, and they've actually, to date, they've won a couple of medals in international competition. So, it's a struggle. It still is a struggle, but they definitely have shown significant progress from the early days.
And that's something I noticed, and maybe it's because it was long ago, but when you're interviewing some of these players and they were talking about those early days when they, like you said, were really, getting pounded pretty good a lot of the time, they always talked about it with a smile on their face, and they always, you know, they never seemed down about it. Like, they knew it happened, and I can't imagine they're very happy about it. But I think you're right. I think it has to do with that pride of being the Irish, you know, national baseball team, because like you said, there was nobody else. You didn't have to really try out almost, because they were hurting just to find guys, you know, to form a full team.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and their biggest worry wasn't whether or not they were going to win or lose or you know, bat 300 in a tournament or anything like that. I mean, they were concerned about those things, definitely. But the big concern was really, if we don't come out and have a good showing, if we continue to get blown out, how are we going to convince, you know, our kids or, you know, teenagers that are looking to play a sport, how are we going to convince them to play? And then what's going to happen in 10 years? And that's always been, I made that film. That film came out in 2006, and I've been, dealing with the team ever since with fundraising efforts, and that's always the concern. How are we going to pass this on to the next generation? Because they don't want to, you know, play for 10 or 15 years and then, you know, look back and find that, you know, no one else is playing in Ireland. They really want to pass it on, and that's another reason why this the field project is so important, because having more places to play in Ireland, it just, number one, it makes it easier for the adult teams to play. I mean, they don't have to spend time putting up a backstop every day and, you know, every weekend or putting up bases and that sort of thing, cutting the grass. You know, if you have a field that's well-maintained and enclosed and you don't have people using it to play, you know, to hit, you know, golf ball, really, they understand that it's a more long-term proposition. It's not a bunch of guys playing on a field in the middle of a park. It's a ballpark, and there's nothing like that in Ireland, and that's really why we're trying to get this project funded, because having a ballpark will really, you know, help kids to see the path from playing in Little League to playing on the Irish national team. And it's, you know, like I said, it's a struggle for them to really do that, because there are a lot of other sports in Ireland, and they're very popular, and they're not trying to compete with those. They're just trying to show kids that, hey, baseball is something, you know, give it a shot. If you like it, if you're good at it, you know, there's a future for you here as a member of the Irish national team if you're good enough.
And that was something that really jumped out at me about this project, is that I think as Americans, we, I don't even want to say take for granted, because we're not even thinking about it really, that, you know, I live in, you know, in Minneapolis, and it's a cold climate. So there's only about 3.5 months of summer if you're lucky, but I can drive 5 minutes and hit a baseball field, you know, whether it's in a park or at a school or something like that. And just the idea that they don't have, I mean, they have this one facility in Dublin, or these two, you know, these two fields, but it's not, you know, like you said, there's no stands, there's no outfield walls. You can't, just the idea that you can't find any of these in Ireland, like they just don't exist. Is that, I mean, I have to imagine that some people have tried in the past, or maybe not, but what's been preventing fields from getting built in Ireland up to this point?
Well, they have tried, and I think there's a couple of factors. Number one is funding. You know, it obviously takes money and support from, you know, local sports governing bodies in Ireland. And they have had support in terms of, you know, helping fund, you know, trips to European championships and uniforms and youth development type stuff. They do have support. It's just a matter of proving that they deserve the same level of support as other sports in Ireland. And they're not at that stage yet. However, you know, the goal of the fundraiser is really to convince American fans to, you know, donate $5 to the cause, or donate whatever they can, and just to kind of show that there is this groundswell of support in America to basically fund this project and to fund, you know, the next step in Irish baseball. And, you know, there really hasn't been any resistance that I'm aware of from people in Ireland. It's just a matter of finding available land and then getting the funding. And, you know, it's the Irish government is actually committed to meet and triple the amount of funds raised in the U.S., and that will bring them to the point where they can actually complete funding and begin building the field. So in this case specifically, there's actually a lot of help forthcoming. We just have to basically show that the American baseball fans, whether Irish or not, are interested enough in seeing this project succeed that, you know, they'll donate, you know, a few dollars to the cost.
And it was an American, or at least an Irish American, Walter O'Malley, the former owner of the Dodgers, who helped bring the first fields over to Ireland. Is that correct?
Peter O'Malley was owner of the Dodgers. I mean, and that was a big deal at the time, and it remains a big deal. He was the one that that put together the first funding project for the first field. And you know, at the time, it took that money, and it took, as far as I understand, it took a lot of convincing to get that public park space to build the first field. And, you know, it's paid off tremendously. Again, kids see that, and they think, wow, you know, I can go play baseball. Before that, and in some areas of Ireland where they can't get to those fields easily, they play baseball by throwing bases down on a field of grass. And kids like it. They do enjoy it. But it's not the same. When you see a real baseball field, it makes you think that it's a real thing. It's a real sport. You may not be aware of it. You don't grow up watching baseball on TV like you would in America. But if you see a field and it's laid out correctly, and there's base paths and, you know, that sort of thing, and there are uniforms, it really helps convince kids that you know, they should give baseball a shot.
Now, thinking positively and thinking forward, let's say you get all the funding that you need for this facility, mm-hmm. and it gets built. Where do you see Irish baseball going in 5, 10, 15 years?
Well, that's a good question. We're starting to see some Irish-born players now that have played, you know, Little League, you know, as an 8-year-old, 9-year-old, 10-year-old, and now they're in their mid-teens, and they're actually developing correct throwing mechanics from the start and, you know, very comfortable with hitting. There was a kid a few years ago who ended up choosing to play rugby, but he had played baseball and was very good, and there was talk of him coming to the U.S. and maybe playing Division II college baseball. He ended up not doing it, but that was the first kind of brush with, you know, an Irish player going to America to really succeed. So I would think that that's going to happen a lot more in the future. I think, you know, we'll start to see some you know, small colleges with Irish ball players. Not a lot, but, you know, the first one will be a big deal. And, you know, I think Ireland's a bit far away from the World Baseball Classic. You know, they're not at the stage yet where they can compete with Italy or the Netherlands, but, you know, it'll probably take a couple of American kids that have Irish citizenship and are maybe minor leaguers or something like that to really help Ireland succeed on the international stage to the point where they might be in a World Baseball Classic. And then the next step would be a major leaguer. I think we're pretty far from that. Probably, barring some sort of miracle, it would probably be about at least 20 years for that, because, you know, the focus right now is really develop kids that, you know how to throw a baseball correctly, because they just don't grow up playing catch with their parents. So, and that's understandable. Baseball is not a big sport there. But, you know, if the kid had the arm strength and the quickness, you know, he could probably be molded into a player that, you know, would become a potential professional baseball player, you know, maybe in 10 or 15 years, maybe a major leaguer in 20.
Well, John Fitzgerald, I wish you luck with your fundraiser, and I hope you get some real ball fields in Ireland soon. Thank you for coming on Stealing Home.
Thanks so much, Dave.
John Fitzgerald is the documentarian responsible for the film The Emerald Diamond, which outlines the history of professional baseball in Ireland. He is currently spearheading a fundraising program to build Ireland's first full baseball facility. You can find out more about that at fieldodreams.com. To end the show, we like to highlight someone from the baseball world who, for actions on the field or off, deserve a little love. It's the MVP of my heart. The Dominican Republic ranks about 90th overall in GDP. They're not a very wealthy nation. Yet over 10% of players in the major leagues come from the Dominican Republic. Players like Albert Pujols, Robinson Cano, and Edinson Volquez. Since the Giants brought over Dominican players in the 60s, players like the Alou brothers and Juan Marichal, there has been a big market for players from the Dominican Republic. This has led to a boon in scouting and development of these players. And the film Pelotero outlines just what that environment is like in baseball now. It came out a few years ago, before MLB put restrictions on foreign contracts, but it's still an eye-opener in showing just how competitive and cutthroat that industry can be. It follows two players, Miguel Sano and Giancarlos Batista, young players getting ready for the International Signing Day, July 2nd. Everything in this film hinges on July 2nd. Not just for the players, but for their trainers, who can get as much as a 35% commission from the player signing bonuses. I don't want to talk much more about it, since I want you all to see it. It's on Netflix streaming, and there's also a DVD you can purchase. But please give it a watch. You will never look at a Dominican-born player the same again, once you realize everything they had to go through, and the regulations they perhaps had to skirt, just to make it to the bigs. For allowing us all to get a peek behind the curtain at this strange, competitive, and often unseen side of baseball, the film Pelotero is the MVP of my heart. Hey, that's it for our show. A big thanks goes out to Aaron Gleeman, Jonah Carey, John Fitzgerald, and Tom Fee. If you'd like links to our other episodes, or maybe have an idea for a story you'd like to see on the show, go to our website, stealinghome.org. I'm your host, David Temple. We'll see you next time.